You're listening to the sweet sounds of the Ink Studs radio show, CITR 101.9 FM. It's a cool day here at the Ink Studs. How you doing, folks? It's about 2 o'clock, 2:03, 2:04, and it's a cold day in Vancouver, but that's okay. Our special guest today is Danny Hellman. We're going to talk about comics with Danny and many other things. His new book is Typhoon.
Typhon. You're not the first person to mispronounce it, Robin. I'll let you know.
Okay.
No, it's been called Tampon. It's been called Typhoon. It's been called Tofu.
Tofu. Yeah, that's...
And the other thing is, I'm not Greek, so I'm only assuming that it's pronounced Typhon, but who knows? They probably pronounce it Typhon or something. But Typhon is a monster out of Greek mythology.
Well... why don't you tell people?
I don't mean to answer questions that haven't yet been asked.
Oh, don't worry, we'll get into that, and then I'll get upset and just stop talking, and then we'll have awkward silence for the hour. I'm by myself today, so who knows? So, Typhon.
Typhon.
Typhon is your latest anthology, unofficially volume 3 of the Legal Action series, I guess, is one way of putting it.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. But it's so different from the Legal Action books that it's really a different sort of creature.
You turned down the suck and turned up the rock?
I turned down the what and turned up the rock?
Oh, turned down the suck God. And turned up the rock. It's a bad rocker phrase.
I don't know that one.
Don't worry, you're not missing out. I'm just kidding. I love the Legal Action anthologies. They're a wonderful mix of some of my favorite folks and more.
Glad you like them.
Yeah. Anytime you can get a nice drawing by Art Spiegelman of Ted Rall being used as a urinal is never a cause to complain. So why don't we set up? Where did Typhon come from, so people that don't know what the Legal Action anthologies were can now know?
All right, well, the Legal Action books, I published those, I guess Legal Action 1 was in 2000, and Legal Action 2 was published in 2004. Those were two black and white trade paperback anthologies that I published while I was in the middle of a nasty libel suit at the hands of... aforementioned Ted Rall. And Typhon, originally I was asking people to contribute to a third volume in the Legal Action series, and then a couple things happened. Most importantly, my wife and I had a daughter, and that kind of put the book project on hold for 2 years. And by the time I got back to work on the book, I realized I wanted to do a different book, and the first two books were connected to the Rall v. Hellman lawsuit, and at this point I don't think anybody really cares about that anymore. So, I decided to scrap Legal Action 3 and do something different.
Nope.
Hopefully better.
What happened with the lawsuit, for those wondering?
Well, what happened with the lawsuit, and I'm a little fuzzy on the exact date, is that Ted Rall's lawyer died, unfortunately, of some kind of brain cancer. It might have been 3 or 4 years ago. And with the death of that lawyer came pretty much the screeching halt to the lawsuit, although it hasn't been officially dismissed or whatever the word for it is. It's still sort of floating in limbo. Rall had some kind of a contingency agreement with his lawyer. In other words, he wasn't going to have to pay him all the money he owed him until they got a settlement out of me or got a judgment against me. So,
because cartoonists have lots of money.
Well, I mean, the idea of suing a cartoonist for $1.5 million is just—it's madness. And I should also point out that everything I say here is opinion.
Yes.
just for the sake of...
And not the opinion of the station.
Not the opinion of Robin or the station, or, you know, solely my opinion, and, you know, and as such, not actionable in court. So, you know, the guy died, and, you know, in order to get a new lawyer to take on what, you know, to a lot of people look like a really crappy case, it would take a lot of money. So I'm assuming that Rawl didn't want to pony up another, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 to retain a new lawyer and to press forward with it.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't really explain the lawsuit, though. That
no. Do you want to kind of tell people about the lawsuit? Because I think it's pretty interesting thing with, like, freedom of speech being kind of ignored, yada yada. You know, just a harmless joke as far as I can opinionatedly see.
You would think. You know, and who knows how it would have played out if it had gone to trial. But what happened was in August of 1999, Ted Rawl wrote a now infamous feature for the Village Voice. It was kind of a, in my opinion, a hatchet job on Art Spiegelman. You know, probably the most respected, or certainly one of the most respected figures in cartooning. You know, just a really sort of nasty attack piece, criticizing his artwork, criticizing his position in the field, and, you know, calling him kind of a petty power broker who, you know, in order to succeed in the comics world, you had to suck up to Art Spiegelman, and, you know, otherwise you had no hope of getting published anywhere. And, yeah, so this piece came out in The Voice, and, you know, it did what it was designed to do. It caused controversy, and, you know, people like me read it and immediately knew that it was
douchey.
Poo. What's the rule about swearing on your show?
Don't say the C word, and listener discretion be advised.
Okay, very good. It was a load of bullshit, you know. So, you know, I wrote a letter to the editors of The Voice, and other cartoonists wrote similar letters, you know, expressing their disdain for the Rawl's piece. And at some point, I posted the text of Rawl's Voice story to the Comics Journal message board. You know, I didn't know how to post a hyperlink at that point, so I just cut and pasted the text of his story, at which point I received an email from Rawl saying, by posting my article, you violated my copyright, but your secret is safe with me. And, you know, I thought that was kind of snarky. And my response to his snarky email to me was to play an email prank on him, which was kind of in a continuum of email pranks that were going on at the time between me and Tony Millionaire and Sam Henderson and other folks. You know, just like I had sent out emails with recipes for how to prepare Tony Millionaire's balls a la King. You know, just others, and we were just always
pickled balls.
Up. What's that?
Pickled balls.
I don't think I did pickled balls. And if I hadn't got sued, I probably would have worked my way around to pickled balls. But plus, it really puts a cramp in your email pranking style, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's a lot of sort of online impersonation going on in my little circle of idiots. And when Rawl sent me that email, I kind of reflexively pulled a similar prank on him, and my, you know, fatal error was to play a joke on somebody I didn't know and who, you know, in my opinion, just completely overreacted. You know, I sent out an email where I claimed to be Ted Rawl, and I... God, you know, it's been 10 years, and I used to have this email mostly memorized, but it was just like, I'm Ted Rawl, and it was kind of a parody of Rawl's self-aggrandizing.
The part that stuck out to me was the one list of Ted Rawl's balls.
Yeah, the email, the subject header in the email was Ted Rawls balls, and I sent out the email, you know, posing as Ted Rawls and sort of praising my own balls, you know, for having the balls to attack the sacred cow of cartoondom. The initial email itself wasn't the prank, or wasn't the best part of the prank, in my opinion. The better part of the prank was the fake emails that I sent in response to that email, which looks to be coming from big figures in publishing, like Cy Newhouse of Condé Nast, and people of that ilk, you know. So Rawl would get the email, and then see responses to it coming from all over the publishing world, from like the highest places in the publishing world. And I guess it worked. I guess the prank was convincing enough. Within a few days, I'd been served a some kind of writ, you know, saying, contact us immediately and we'll talk about a settlement. So from day one, they were trying to, like, squeeze money out of me. That was a tough time.
But luckily far in the past.
Luckily far in the past, yeah. At this point, it's kind of a dim memory, you know. It's like any traumatic time in your life, you kind of try to forget about it.
Well, let's talk about Typhon.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the difference that you wanted, the change from the previous Legal Action anthologies to Typhon?
Yeah, the big difference is it's full color. I wanted to kick it up a notch, as Emeril would say. Do a full color book so that, you know, you could have some nice, lush artwork instead of, you know, all that black and white stuff. It's a little different format. It's 10 by 8 3/4, so it's larger than the Legal Action books, which were 6 by 9. So it's kind of a nicer format for looking at, you know, pages of lush, full-color art.
Mm-hmm.
And, so it allows all of the contributors to, you know, really show their stuff.
Now, did they have any kind of set criteria to follow when you're going for submissions, or is it just people submitting what they felt?
Yeah, I'm not really a big fan of themed anthologies, so I don't say, okay, everybody do something about sandwiches or, you know, something like that. My favorite way to edit a book is just to see what people have lying around that hasn't been published.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to get into a situation where somebody's doing something specifically for the book, because then I'm in trouble if I don't like the end product. I mean, there are some strips in here that were done specifically for the book, and fortunately, I'm happy with them all, but I would much rather go to a, you know, cartoonist X and look at, you know, three or four strips that haven't been published and pick one that I like. And the tough thing there is that it's pretty rare when you find somebody who's got a bunch of unpublished strips.
Everyone gets it all out as much as they can.
Pretty much. Pretty much, you know, like, people ask me for unpublished strips, and I never have one. You know, like, I get asked to contribute to anthologies every once in a while, and, you know, like, I'll usually try to talk them into letting me do, like, a single-page drawing or, you know, like, a fake ad or something, because it just takes so long to do a new comic strip, at least for me. I'm not fast.
Well, you also do a lot of commercial work on the side as well.
Well, on the side, it's really...
Or not
me,
the side, as the main thing.
Yeah, I mean, for me, illustration is, you know, the way I try to make a living. And, you know, the comics are kind of a hobby, you know, and they're always on a distant back burner to, you know, whatever illustration assignments I've got going on at the time. And, I've been lucky enough to be pretty busy with illustration, so I'm, you know, I try to squeeze out one or two strips a year, but that, you know, if I can. And, you know, as a result, I'm almost always the person who publishes them.
I'm going to do... Oh, go ahead.
There's not really a thought there.
Okay. I'm going to do a quick song break.
Sure.
And then we'll get into some of the content of that book. Any particular song you want me to play?
Any of them is fine. I guess Squatty Roo is my second favorite of those four.
There we go. Okay. CITR 101.9 FM. This is Squatty Roo. Who's the artist of Squatty Roo?
God only knows. I picked them out of those bachelor pad. Rhino did those bachelor pad compilations. I picked them mainly because they were short. I was looking for songs that were like 2 minutes and under. So
nice. Yeah. Nice quick snippets.
I wasn't going to like make you listen to Carnival 9 by Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. It'd be about half the show.
I have played a 12-minute song on the show once, and it was quite the lengthy break. I
don't know. Yeah, that, you know, how can you talk about Pen Nibs when you just heard a 12-minute...
Unless it's a song about Pen Nibs. Come on, someone do a song. We'll be right back with Inkstud, CITR 101.9 FM, and Danny Hillman. CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstuds. Something about that music makes you feel relaxed. Today's guest is Danny Hillman. We're talking about his latest book, Typhon. And don't forget, next week I'll be yakking with Tom Neely, author of The Marvelous Blot. And next month will be the Inkstuds Canadian Focus Month, where I'll be yakking with people like David Collier, Ray Fenwick, Scott Chandler, and Camila DiRico, and some other folks. Mark Bell, Chris Von Zombathy. The list goes on. Now, Danny, Typhon, yep. One difference I really found striking in it is that the legal action, there was a lot of underground folks in it, which was nice to see some new stuff. I think it was like the Kim Deitch stuff was some of his newest stuff that he has out. And Typhon doesn't have that underground. Is that kind of a purposeful thing to focus on more newer work by newer people?
No, I mean, the thing about the underground, you know, the presence of the underground legends, especially in Legal Action 1, was I had a lot of sympathy at that time. And mm-hmm. you know, people like Art Spiegelman and Robert Crumb and Robert Williams and Kim Deitch and Spain Rodriguez, these were all guys who were willing to help me out and you know, donate work to the cause. And with Typhon, there really isn't a cause. You know, like I can't say, please help me out, I'm being sued. So I didn't even really approach those guys on this go around. You know, there's a lot of talented cartoonists out there, and I think part of the fun of doing these anthologies for me is to find people whose work isn't that widely seen.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to look too hard to find Robert Crumb or Spain. I mean, they're all just huge talents whose work I have nothing but admiration for. But it's easy to see them, you know. It's not so easy to see some of the people in Typhoon.
Like Rick Trembles.
Well, especially that trip. I was at a slideshow that Rick did in Montreal. This was about 4 years ago, and he did that strip as a slideshow and read it, and it has to be the dirtiest comic strip I've ever seen. It's kind of like breathtaking in its dirtiness and honesty. It's just like, you know, it's this confession of his kinkiness, and I immediately wanted to publish it, and luckily for me, it had never been published anywhere except for, you know, his own mini comics.
Was it originally in color, or did he color it for this?
I think he colored it for Typhoon. I don't remember. It may have been in color in the slideshow, so he may have had a color version of it. I mean, a lot of the strips that you see in Typhoon did need to be colored specifically for this book, because I did start to collect material with the black and white book in mind, and then sort of midstream changed course and asked people to color their work, and even a few of them who weren't able to color it, I colored a couple of people's strips.
And there's one strip that is actually in black and white, or a couple.
Yeah, there's a handful of black and white strips.
But they seem like they shouldn't be colored anyways.
They were, the black and white strips in Typhoon, the ones that remain in black and white are the ones that I felt had to be in black and white. The color would have detracted.
Yeah. Like the, There Is Law, or is it There Is a Law?
Yeah.
That was fantastic.
It's a very nice strip.
One thing that there is a continuous theme, even if unintentional, is they're pretty filthy, or pretty dire, I guess is a term.
Well, what did you say, dire?
Yeah.
Oh, sort of grim or scary?
Yeah, just dreadful happenings. Not that I don't enjoy comics with horrible things happening to people. It's just, it seems like a theme.
Well, I mean, there's definitely some disturbing material. There's definitely some raunchy material. I think there's also a lot of funny stuff. I think that I'm the sort of person who values artwork over writing. You know, there's always kind of a tension between people who prefer, or at least who value good writing over good art. And, you know, I fall in the other camp. You know, like, I would almost always rather look at beautiful art, and if there's no story, or if the story's not that great, I'm willing to let them slide for that. You know.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that I think that the theme of Typhoon, if there is one, is it's art that I thought was really nice and worth looking at.
Tell me about some of the newer, younger folk that you've put in Typhoon.
Well,
I know there's a lot of people, but try.
A lot of people in here. So I'm going to flip through the book, and there's a wonderful strip in here by Hans Rickheit, who some people may have seen his book, Chrome Fetus. I think that Hans is just a wonderful cartoonist, and definitely some of the more disturbing stuff in the book.
Kind of... reminds me a little of Rick Geary in a whole different direction.
Yeah, somebody else made that connection. It's funny, I never saw Rick Geary and Hans's work, but I sort of see it now that it's been pointed out. But this is, I guess, an allegory maybe about politics. It's a great strip, and we have a strip by Bob Sikoriak and Rich Tomasso, and Gregory Benton did a couple of strips for me, and we have Glenn Head of Hotwire fame, and David Paleo from Buenos Aires is another like phenomenally talented guy whose work, I guess he's getting published and starting to get published in anthologies here and there. He was in Glenn's Hot Wire books. And he's just a phenomenal draftsman. There was a show here at the Scott Ader Gallery in Brooklyn, and a couple of David Paleo's pencil originals are on the wall, and they're truly breathtaking. I mean, somebody's gotta buy those. So, you know, Eric Thirio is also a wonderful cartoonist from Montreal who's been in both Legal Action books, and he's doing a strip that's kind of like a space opera involving brain transplants of Hitler and Stalin into robot bodies, and completely insane.
I really enjoyed the Summer of 7-Eleven strip, but I think that was it. Mike Kroll? Kroll.
That's by Hawk Kroll, who I've never met in person, but whose work I've enjoyed for years. And, yeah, that's a sort of a more slice-of-life kind of strip of working in a cruddy 7-Eleven somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that's a nice one. And, there's a guy named Derek Ballard whose work, whose drawings I think are really beautiful. He has a strip in here. What's that one called? Burn. Another big favorite of mine who's also been in the other Legal Action books is a guy named Bruno Natalin who's working under the pen name Hugo. And he has a strip about this nerdy character, Virgil. And it's just sort of a...
Mm-hmm. Kind of reminds me of the guy from Happiness.
Yeah, you know, did I see Happiness?
The Philip Seymour Hoffman character. Stick things to the wall.
God, that's like 10 years ago, right? I barely remember that.
It's a fabulous flick. Not for the kids.
Yeah, I remember there's some spooge at the end on a railing, right? And the dog licks it up. That's pretty much the only thing I remember about that movie.
It's like the last minute.
It's not that far off from what's that guy's name? That director.
So long. Yeah.
It's sort of about sexually frustrated nerd, having fantasies about his favorite porn star and. Things go downhill pretty rapidly.
The Bald Eagle strip.
Mm-hmm.
That one's
Bald Eagles, also known as Victor Cairo.
Okay, it's maddening.
Yeah. There's a couple of strips in this book that defy the reader's ability to comprehend. I think in the case of that strip, I mean, Victor's artwork is amazing.
It's just so textured. Yeah. Is that the word I'm looking for? It's very rich. It's full. There's a lot happening in it, and I just, too much to handle.
And the way he writes, he's kind of writing in some kind of code. Kind of like you have to, in order to figure out what he's really writing about, you have to think really hard.
I don't read comics to think hard, Danny.
I know I don't. I just look at the picture.
Well, it's a fabulous book nonetheless. I'm very happy that you finally able to give birth to this book.
I'm glad you think so, and I just found out from the folks that are shipping it, the book was printed in Hong Kong, and they're due to arrive this coming Monday, so hopefully it'll be working its way into stores in the weeks to come, and it'll also be available on my website, which is www.dannyhellman.com.
Spelt how it sounds.
Spelt how it sounds.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about your own personal history, Danny? Because I don't know much about where you come from, how you got started in comics, and that kind of thing.
Well, I'm from Queens, New York. I was born in 1964, which makes me 43. Where do you want me to start? Do you want me to start at in kindergarten? Or?
No. What got you into comics? And when did you go, okay, I'm can be a cartoonist?
Well, I definitely always read comics as a kid. My earliest memory of a comic was in my grandparents' basement. I think one of my older cousins has an issue of X-Men that they had scribbled on with a crayon. And I remember, I couldn't have been more than like six or something. And it just seemed very strange, like it was a Marvel comic. And Marvel's always struck me as strange when I was a kid. I guess I started out reading, Archie and Gold Key comics and classics, illustrated comics, and over the years worked my way to the superhero stuff and started off with DC. And later, in my teen years, started reading Marvel, and they felt like the hard stuff. To me, as a kid, at least, very strange stories, and they somehow felt more adult than the Archies that I've been reading. And I always drew. I think, like all kids, draw, in kindergarten and grade school, and it's really just a question of when do they stop? And some of them don't stop drawing, and I'm one of those kids who kept on drawing, probably due to the encouragement of my mom, who was kind of a frustrated artist herself. I went to an art high school, the High School of Art and Design here in, it was in Manhattan.
Is that the same one that, L. Feldstein and L. Jaffe went years ago?
I think that the school started out its life as the School of Industrial Arts, if I'm not mistaken. And I think, a lot of people went there. What's that?
A lot of folks went there. That's.
Yeah, I think even Spiegelman may have gone there. I'm a little confused because SVA, the School of Visual Arts, also started its life out under a different name. One of them was the School of Industrial Arts, and one of them was a cartooning school. I think that SVA was started as a cartooning school, if I'm right about that. I'm not sure, but yeah, a lot of cartoonists over the years went to the High School of Art and Design. And after that, I did go to SVA for about 3 weeks, but it was really just such a rerun of my high school experience that I couldn't face 4 years of that. So I lasted about 3 weeks, and I also went to the Art Students League, which is a venerable art institution on Manhattan's West Side, where you take life drawing classes and kind of pay by the session. You can just go and spend $10 and draw from the model for a few hours. And I did a lot of that for a lot of years in my 20s, just a lot of figure drawing to work on anatomy and drawing chops.
Now, how did you get involved with doing stuff for Screw Magazine, another venerable...
Screw Magazine is the first place I ever got paid to... the first place that paid me to publish my artwork. Prior, it's interesting, when I was in high school, I was living in Brooklyn at the time with my mom, and our upstairs neighbor shared a summer home with Bill Mantlo, who was a writer for Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
Who has had some kind of unfortunate head injury, and I think is disabled as a result from a rollerblading accident.
Really? Wow!
I heard about this a few years ago. But at the time that I knew him, he hadn't had the accident, and my neighbor introduced me to Mantlo, and Mantlo thought my work showed some promise, and he had a project that he was working on for was pitching to Marvel. There was an arcade game called Robotron 3000 at the time, and he wanted to do a licensed comic book based on it. I don't know if you ever played it, but it was one of my favorites at the time. I can remember my friend Sean Taggart and I used to go and play Robotron 3000 on 8th Street into the wee hours.
Robotron 3000, that sounds like the best name ever.
Yeah, and your mission was to save the last human family. like you were the robot cyborg hero. It's kind of like Terminator before Terminator came out.
Maybe they should have sued Cameron instead of Harlan Ellison.
Harlan Ellison. Well, those episodes of Outer Limits, when you watch them, they really do, Terminator does owe a lot to those episodes, or maybe they're just themes that run through science fiction. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Probably shouldn't go in that direction.
No, we'll stay out of that.
But back to Bill Mantlo, he had me working on some test pages, which we were going through multiple revisions to try to get them up to the point where we could take them and show them to Tom DeFalco, who is one of the big editors at Marvel. And a couple of days before I was due to show to go to meet with Tom DeFalco, I was hanging around with this evil friend of mine at the time, and I was telling him how I needed a haircut because at that point I had a full head of hair, like a big silly hippie afro. And he said, "Oh, I can cut hair. I cut my sister's hair all the time." And I let him try to cut my hair, and he didn't know how to cut hair. And he started laughing as soon as he started cutting my hair. Huge chunks of my hair were falling to the ground. So he did such a bad job that I felt the only way I could salvage it was to shave my head. And this was in the very early 80s, at a point when the shaved head thing was not as popular as it is now.
It had a different connotation.
Kind of, yeah. This is like the era of Geraldo and skinheads throwing chairs on talk shows. So when I went to meet Bill Mantlo, before we went up to meet Tom DeFalco, he took one look at me and said, "What did you do, you idiot?" And so we go up to meet Tom DeFalco, and he kind of looks at me and looks at the art and just says, "This is fan art."
Aww.
So I had kind of a crushing disappointment with my brush with Marvel, and spent about three or four years not drawing much and really just kind of smoking a lot of pot and doing nothing. And I was a bike messenger for a few years, and my dispatcher at the messenger service was in a band. This is a guy named D Pop, who had a band called Floor Kiss. He somehow found out that I could draw, and I started doing posters for his band. And from there, the guy who I mentioned playing video games with, Sean Taggart, he had been up to Screw to meet the art director, Kevin Hine, and he had done one or two Screw covers, and a couple other friends of mine had also done Screw covers, and I figured, I've got to do something. I've got to make some money. I have no money coming in. So I took those band posters that I'd done for Floor Kiss, and this would have been about 1989, went up to Screw's legendary 14th Street offices and met Kevin Hine, who is now one of my oldest friends. He published my work then and published it for another 15 years.
Is he the guy I met when I went with you to the
offices?
Yeah,
when you and Bougie came to New York, you guys showed up at sort of the tail end of Screw.
Mm-hmm. But at least we got there.
At least you saw it. And the other thing is, you saw the last office. You didn't see the real office. You saw Screw well after it had jumped the shark.
Yeah.
I forget which year it was when they moved out of their 14th Street office, but the office on 14th Street was just a grungy place where there was graffiti on the walls from 20 years worth of cartoonists. Say what you will about Screw, it's kind of a cruddy porn rag, but the amazing thing about Screw is that almost every cartoonist in the New York or beyond New York, there are people on the West Coast. It was a place where cartoonists could go for a quick buck.
Mm-hmm. That was the surprising thing, and I didn't know about that. And Kevin was talking about how, like, I guess Spiegelman did some Screw, didn't he? And Spain and Crom and tons of people.
Spiegelman may have been in the National Screw for for a brief period, they had a Slick Screw magazine that was national, and I think Spiegelman might have been in that, if I'm not mistaken, but I don't remember him in the paper, but
definitely Spain.
Spain did a lot of screw covers, a lot of really great screw covers. A lot of the guys who worked on Stop Magazine, you know Stop Magazine?
No.
Stop Magazine was something that Peter Bagg was in it, and Ken Wiener, now known as Ken Avedor, who's also in Typhon, by the way, and J.D. King and John Holmstrom. Like, they were a crew of like-minded cartoonists who had come out of SVA a few years. Those guys are all, I guess, about 5 years older than me. So when I was just out of high school and just starting to drink beer in East Village bars, you would find this magazine on the bar, you know, on the top of the bar called Stop, and it was this little newsprint zine, you know, with black plus two colors, and the reason why it was black plus two colors is because it was actually being ganged up on the press runs with Screw. It was kind of a Screw side project. Ken Wiener and this other cartoonist, Bruce Carlton, both were art directors at Screw. You know, I think Carlton had the job first, and then Ken Wiener had it next. And, you know, so as a result of that, they did this really cool side project that they ganged up on Screw's press run. And it was just, you know, real freewheeling, silly cartoons by those guys. Can't remember where I was going with that. But at any rate, Screw was the first place that I got published and got paid for my art. And from there, I was able to go up to the New York Press, which at the time was a really wonderful alternative weekly paper here in New York. It has since been sold a few times and has gone way downhill. But at the time, the publisher, Russ Smith, and the editor, John Strausbaugh, and the art director, my longtime friend, Michael Gentile, these were, you know, really great people doing a really great paper. And you know, I started doing a lot of illustrations for that paper, and from there, you know, all over the place. But, you know, I got my illustration start at Screw, and continued to happily, you know, do stuff for Kevin until the paper closed.
Was it Drew Freeman that got his start at Screw as well?
No. He didn't start through. Screw was started by Al Goldstein.
No. Did he get a start at Screw?
Oh, did he get a start there? He did some stuff for Screw, and his brother, is it Josh Friedman?
Yeah. Josh Allen.
Yeah, he wrote the Tales of Times Square. He was an editor at Screw.
Oh, okay. There
we go. For a while. And he also ghost wrote Goldstein's recent autobiography. So, Drew Friedman definitely did some Screw covers, and I'm assuming he found his way there thanks to his brother.
Having someone in the family there probably helps a lot.
I mean, there's a lot of great stuff. You know, like, I have my own collection of old Screw covers that's in a box. And, you know, one of the things that Kevin Hine and I talk about every few years is, you know, trying to do a coffee table book of Screw covers, but we have to wait and see. Right now, Screw is owned by one of three partners who kind of ran the business into the ground. And like I said, this is all opinion, folks. None of this is actionable. So it'd be tough to do a Screw coffee table book until some ownership of issues of Screw are settled. So don't hold your breath. But it would be a great book. It would be the kind of book that every fan and scholar of cartooning would have to have.
One of those tomes, those testamentable tomes.
Yes, but hopefully not one of those tomes that you can't fit on your bookshelf. Yeah, like physically fit on a bookshelf.
I've got a shelf of those now.
Well, I know that, you know, everybody's talking about this Kramer's Ergo book that's going to be as big as a door.
It's going to be as big as the Walton Skezik's Sunday's book, and that's a hard one for me to read. I actually have to put it on a table in order to read it. I tried reading it in my lap, and it was overtaking me. I like it, but, you know.
If there, you know what? You want to know what the theme for Typhon is? The theme for Typhon is that you can actually physically hold the book, and you don't need some kind of structure to prop it up. You know, human scale book.
Not to be held, or you don't need to be a giant in order to read it.
Yeah, they're not made for, you know, huge giant people, and you don't need a crane to get it home from the store. Not to rag on Kramer's Ergo.
Or the new Gary Panter collection, which is also equally.
Are those huge?
It's not. It's just. It's a big book.
Yeah, they're thick.
Yeah.
They're hefty volumes, but they're not.
No.
It's not like that Panter book that I can't fit on the Jimbo and Purgatory book.
Yeah, no, it's not like that, which sits with my Roz and my Walton Sigizek's book.
Yeah, I was having this conversation with my friend Pete Shaw, who's also in Typhon, and we were just talking about all these ridiculous books that you can't fit on your shelf. You kind of need a special shelf.
It's on top of the shelf.
Yeah.
There we go. Enough about other people's comics, though. Tell me, you do a lot of characters. Anyone particular you've enjoyed doing? Any hatred of doing characters of people?
Characters that I've done in my comics?
In your commercial work.
Oh, in my commercial? Oh, caricatures?
Yeah.
People that I hate?
People that, you know, characters you've really enjoyed having fun kind of pulling out the parts of the personality and whatnot.
I've done so many caricatures, hard for me to think of. My favorite caricature is an easy one. My least favorite caricature is a hard one. And the hardest ones are usually the prettiest people. I don't know, somebody like Sharon Stone, or I remember having a lot of trouble with Denzel Washington. It's good to get an assignment where you're asked to draw somebody who's a little odd looking. Easiest kind of person to draw, and you know, people who are just sort of pretty, you know, newscaster-looking people—they're almost impossible. Like, I remember getting an assignment from Entertainment Weekly where I had to draw Kathy Lee Gifford, who's, you know, just a very bland-looking person. I remember sweating that one a lot.
You could just have
like the, what's that?
I guess you can't draw the shrill voice that gives people seizures.
No, you can't do that. Somebody like Donald Trump, he's easy to draw. He's got that ridiculous
mop
shelf of hair. I've drawn so many caricatures, it's hard to pick one out where I could say, oh, I really got a thrill out of drawing I.F. Stone.
Here's a more comics-related question. What's the deal with Craig Yao and you? Why the hate?
There is no hate. The deal with Craig Yao and me is that I'm going to come clean about that. About this, Craig Yao and I have staged some
mock feuds.
Yeah, mock feuds on the message boards for purposes of hyping. He and I and P. Shaw and Glenn Head shared a table at Mocha 2 weekends ago, and. You know, we were on the message boards threatening to stab each other, and I was asking if somebody would protect me from Craig Yao. And in spite of his stupid haircut, I have nothing but love and admiration for Craig and his artwork, and his books are just wonderful.
Stunning, stunning little collections.
Yeah, and they're just treasures. You know, like somebody who's willing to find that stuff and put it together and put it out there for, you know, people like me who don't know everything about comics history. That's just you know, we all owe Craig Yao a hearty thank you.
Thanks, Craig.
Thanks, Craig, wherever you are. And, you know, get your hair cut, hippie.
Or maybe let the rest grow.
Or let the rest grow, yeah. I mean, you know.
What's the deal? Are you going to be doing any cons in promotion for Typhon?
Well, I don't think I'll be doing any out-of-town cons because it's just too damned expensive, and we have a kid now, so I can't really just leave my poor wife Linda alone with our daughter for 3 days while I go to San Francisco and have fun. We'll probably do a couple of book signings. I'm talking to Rupert Bonberg in Montreal about doing something there, and Hans Rickeitz in Philadelphia. He was talking about doing a signing there, and we'll do signings here in New York, and maybe an art show, but not really cons. I did MoCA because it was local.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have to rent a room or fly on a plane.
Just get on the subway.
Yeah, just all I had to do was hop on the R train, and there I was. The one that I love to do is the one in San Francisco, the Ape Con.
Mm-hmm.
Just because San Francisco is such a nice place. So that's really the only one that I'll regret not doing, but it's just so expensive.
Oh, it's stupid expensive to go traveling. Well, we're nearing the end of our hour.
Wow.
The Inksuds hour. So I want to thank you for taking the time with us to discuss.
Thank you, Robin.
The Typhon, and also I very much enjoyed your story as well.
I'm glad you liked it.
Because you've got a new piece in there.
That strip, the main character is also a real life guy whose name is Guy Gonzalez, who is also a long time cover artist for Screw. But I won't launch into that story, although it's a good one.
Well, it's an enjoyable strip nonetheless, and reminded me of my brief time in New York where we wandered through Show World.
It was still there?
Yeah.
Show World still there when you were here?
Yeah, I was generous enough to buy Bougie a couple of minutes in the Peep Show booth.
Well, that can't be the original Show World.
No, it is.
Really?
As we walked out, my cell phone rang, and it was Jamie Gillis telling Bougie all these crazy stories of Show World in the 70s, and yeah, it's the exact same one.
Same location, same place.
Yeah, it's probably smaller than it used to be,
yeah.
Maybe, but no, it's still the same filthy, sticky floors.
Wow, I didn't know that was still there, because all that stuff got scattered by Giuliani.
Damn you, Giuliani.
Damn him. Well, I think hopefully we've seen the last of his ass.
Yeah, he pretty much stunk up that attempt. Well, thank you very much, Danny. And
my pleasure.
I look forward to any more comic stuff you may have going out, even if it'll be a while.
It'll be a year or two.
There we go. Well, maybe there'll be. Oh, yeah. People should also know that you're in the latest Hotwire anthology from Glenn Head, right?
Yes, I am.
So there we go. A couple things to check out. Thanks very much, Danny. And have a swell evening.
Okay.
Bye.
Talk to you soon.
Danny Hellman, anthology Typhon, and also check out Legal Action Books. All of them are great. Like I said, not for kids comics, but it's not filthy. Well, it is filthy, but it's not like disgustingly filthy. I enjoyed it. They're good stuff, and I think you will too. Like I said, next week our guest will be Tom Neely. Going to talk about The Blot, which is awesome. I really enjoyed that book, and it's really fantastic, and I think you should all check it out too. I think he even won an Ignatz at SPX, which is an award in the shape of a brick. So anyone that gets a brick for their comic has to be cool in my books. Up next, we got Crimes and Treasons. See y'all later.